This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Lynn Stewart's husband, Ralph Poynter.
Lynn has been in prison now 2 years in a so-called medical facility. Horrendous conditions, she remains strong and wants us to think about the others who are suffering even worse than she is.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Last week, here on Law and Disorder, we ran an amazing show on an event marking 30 years of incarceration of Mamia Abu-Jamal. And Heidi, I know you were down there on December 9th. You put together that show with three remarkable excerpts that I would encourage people to listen to at Law and Disorder. And now we have another update on Mamia's case. During that last show, of course, Heidi, I know you talked about how he was no longer going to receive the death penalty. And now we have another event because he's now apparently been moved from the prison he was in. What's happened with Mamia?
Well, I want to start, Michael, by just saying that the event at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia had 1,200 attendees present, and it was a remarkable outpouring, really, of love for Mumia, who called in at 8 p.m. and could hear people standing, clapping, screaming for him. The last 30 seconds of his 15-minute call, the house went crazy.
That's incredible. That's
it
just
was
wonderful.
So stunning. And he said it made him so happy. This event happened, it just turned out, 2 days after D.A. Seth Williams in Philadelphia announced they would not be seeking a new sentencing phase trial. So while the event had been planned several months in advance, the timing made it all the more animated with excitement. And as many of our listeners may know, Maureen Faulkner, the widow of Daniel Faulkner, actually...
Daniel Faulkner is the...
The police officer who was shot 30 years ago. She actually urged people to write and call the governor to try to stop Mumia's call from SCI Green. And of course, well, that did not happen. But what did happen was the police...
SCI Green?
That's the facility where he's been for 17 years, or was, until last week. But basically, and he was able to call in for 15 minutes through a phone call, but they had helicopters, police had helicopters flying around above, and police on motorcycles were revving their engines. I guess they thought they could drown out the sound of the call, but this is the Constitution Center, which is huge, a beautiful building with ceiling-high glass walls all around. You can see outside, but we heard Mumia. It was fascinating. And then, in a kind of odd move, because we were expecting the next phase to be a resentencing hearing by a judge in Philadelphia in the Court of Common Pleas. But in the middle of the night, a few days after that event, Mumia was actually moved to a different facility, medium security, called the SCI Mahanoy. It's in Frackville, Pennsylvania. And he's been in the wing where they have solitary confinement. So he's basically in a more punitive unit. But people should not call the facility to complain about it because the Department of Corrections is saying the person who's calling the shots is still the DA and the city of Philadelphia. So people should not call to complain about this.
How long do you expect he'll be in the special segregation?
No way
unit?
Of knowing.
Because he should be put back in general population.
That's what is expected. I should note, I think the first few days there were obviously moving from a place you've been for so long to a new facility is a shock. And for a few days, he didn't have access to his books or writing materials. But I understand he has a few books right now. So I went to visit him, actually, last week. And we had a great visit. The prison is much less rigid than the maximum security facility, SCI Green, where he'd been for so long. So hopefully things will continue to improve for him and he'll be moved into general population.
I mean, in the context of things, I mean, it's been quite remarkable as we brought this to our listeners' attention over many years, and Heidi, you in particular, who've been working on the case and visiting for many years. I mean, here he is no longer on death row. He's still in solitary, but will be moved, we hope, to general population. And, of course, it's still 30 years, and you can't get over 30 years, and it's right now facing a life imprisonment sentence. So it's still very difficult, but you look for, I wouldn't call the difference between life and death a small victory. It's a huge victory against the state. I mean, we shouldn't deny, and it's the people's support that really made a difference here.
And I think the December 9th event really showed that we're facing a reinvigorated movement, especially in Philadelphia. And that's exciting. That will energize people. Mumia's face and voice was heard. And there's a new film coming out about him in the next few months that really focuses on Mumia the person. It talks a lot about the books he's written, his body of work over the years, his radio journalism, his continuing journalism. So we have to look forward to that, as well as, I think, this is an important time. It's a reminder, really, of all the other men, especially in Pennsylvania, who are in solitary confinement. We've talked about the case of Russell Maroon Schultz, the former Black Panther, who is approaching 70 years of age. And I spoke to his daughter, Teresa, last week also. The family and friends are relaunching a campaign to try to get Russell Maroon Schultz off solitary confinement, where really he's had what I understand to be a spotless record for years. And there are many stories like this of individuals who are facing really torturous conditions to be alone in a cell all day long, to have no contact. And I think they're allowed something like a visitor a week, one phone call a week. So Mumia, I think, wants us all to remember everyone else who's in a difficult situation. And we don't hear about these stories as much.
I think that's absolutely critical. I mean, he does stand for everybody else who's been on death row for many years, many of whom are still there and who are under unbearable conditions. Thank you, Heidi, for your work on this for many, many years.
The Center for Constitutional Rights is representing Julian Assange on some aspects of his case. Can you explain?
Well, the key area in which the center has started to work as attorneys for Julian Assange is the monitoring of the Bradley Manning trial going on at Fort Meade as we speak, but will be over by the time our listeners hear this show. And the key, of course, for Julian Assange was to make sure he had people in the trial who could monitor the trial because of the allegations by the U.S. government and others that somehow Bradley Manning was the person who gave the documents to WikiLeaks. And so it was important for us to get people into the trial to hear what the testimony would say. There's a couple of aspects of the case that, you know, it's been covered a lot, but there's certain things that struck me in observing what our lawyers did when they were sitting there and the trial itself. Our listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with the Bradley Manning case, but just in case you're not, he is the young private who allegedly leaked the collateral murder video to WikiLeaks. That's the one that shows U.S. helicopter killing Reuters journalists. He allegedly leaked other documents as well to WikiLeaks, possibly the State Department cables, etc. And as a result of that, he was picked up, put into solitary confinement, and at the time of his trial had been in jail for an astounding 567 days, almost 2 years, without any kind of real proceeding. And the proceeding that he is now engaged in, or that they've put him in front of, is called an Article 32 proceeding. It's part of a courts martial, and it's the equivalent of what's a preliminary hearing in a state criminal case. It's, is there probable cause to hold him for a real trial, or if you want to call any military trial a real trial, a courts martial? And you need probable cause to do that. This is efforts by the government to put on a bunch of witnesses that talk about Bradley Manning. Now, a lot's come out, and you can read a lot about it. It's tweeted often. But, of course, it's not tweeted from the courtroom, because one of the outrageous restrictions here is neither press nor attorneys representing Julian Assange or anybody else can bring in any electronic instruments into the courtroom, so you can't do anything in the courtroom. Somebody had a cell phone on them, apparently, out of like a number of people, and they have send out a signal of some sort that can pick up any electronic instruments that anybody has in the courtroom.
And that's then so high tech.
They stopped the court proceedings and they said somebody has a cell phone.
It's like getting caught on an airplane right before you leave.
It makes it very hard to cover the trial. But the other thing about the trial that's interesting, and you know, there was an expression, military justice is to justice as military music is to music. And it's true. This thing is, considering it's the most important courts martial or Article 32 probably in the history of the United States, but certainly in the last 50 years, it's utterly shoddy and outrageous. So, for example, the first witness that appeared on behalf of the government at the Manning case was a woman investigator of some sort from Hawaii. But did she actually come to court so she could be cross-examined? No, she didn't. She called on a cell phone from Hawaii.
On Skype?
Well, I don't even think it was Skype. It was a cell phone. So the question is, how do you cross-examine someone on a cell phone? And then to the great, I don't even know, great embarrassment, because I don't think the Army or government is embarrassed by anything, the cell phone connection, of course, was bad. And they had to delay the trial half an hour while she found a landline. This in a case in which she has a charge that carries the death penalty,
right,
aiding the enemy. Now, the government has said they're not going to ask for the death penalty, but this is the case in which they stick on some investigator from Hawaii on a cell phone that doesn't work.
And where is this actually taking place? In Washington, D.C.?
Fort Meade in Maryland.
Oh, right, Fort Meade.
There's actually a courtroom there.
And is he represented by military?
By a former military lawyer who's now in private practice and is a military lawyer, David Coombs. There's a million things you could go through with this trial. There's a million things about Bradley Manning, from his solitary confinement, his stripping, his torture, to the fact whether he should be prosecuted at all for essentially revealing, if he did, war crimes by the United States. So the whole prosecution is incredible when the people who actually, for example, killed the Reuters journalists weren't ever investigated or prosecuted for what looks to many people on the tape for a murder.
Murder.
So apart from Abu Ghraib and torture and waterboarding and everything else, so they have this 24-year-old kid now, a young man,
right,
21 at the time.
Growing up in solitary confinement.
Right, and for doing something that should make him a national hero.
Right.
Let's be clear. So the interesting thing for me about the trial, one of the interesting things is how much has come out about computers and how they're used. And people ought to go on various sites. Wired has some. There's tweets from WikiLeaks Legal, a guy named Trevor Tim. He's written articles. The Guardian has a bunch of stuff. What's interesting is when they got Manning's computer, they had the expert testify what was left on it. And he said, here's what Manning or somebody tried to do. They didn't know who. Tried to erase. And the way you do it, you know, when you delete, and all our listeners ought to know this, and they probably do, when you delete, the material is still on the computer and can be recovered. So key point number one, deletion is not enough to get rid of embarrassing material or anything else you don't want on your computer.
You have to destroy the hard drive, right?
Well, basically, you're better off throwing the thing in the ocean. That's
right,
for sure.
Right.
Hitting with a hammer and then throwing it in the ocean. That's probably the only, in my view, the only
right,
real way to do it. But Manning tried another way, and there's a program. It's called Zeroing Out. And he got a hold of the program. And what you do is you use the program, and I don't know if it's Manning didn't necessarily do it, whoever tried to erase his computer, because there was no evidence of who did. It's a program that puts zeros in the place of everything on the computer, on your hard drive. And you don't just run it once. Whoever had Manning's computer ran it 35 times.
Oh.
And that's what it actually takes to get rid of the stuff.
Wow.
But the program was stopped for some reason midway or didn't complete its task. There was another effort to zero it out, which is basically you're filling every vacant space on the computer with zeros.
Right.
And that time, they only did it once. And you have to do it many times. So the second lesson, if you're not going to toss the thing in the brink, I mean in the ocean, and hit it with hammers and pour acid all over it,
you have to zero it out at least 35 times.
You have to zero it out. And there's a program to do it, just in case you can't afford to buy the new computer. Apparently, according to the government, if you believe the government's witness, and of course I say all this because this is what the government said, a third point, and I think it's really important, the government claims that they found a chat log between Bradley Manning and a computer that was identified in some way with Julian Assange. And of course, that doesn't mean Julian was on that computer. It doesn't even mean what the government is saying is true. But that is one of the first public links in which they've tried to pull together WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. Now, that doesn't make Julian Assange or WikiLeaks guilty of anything.
Right.
It doesn't make him any different than a New York Times reporter who talks to a secure source in the Pentagon.
Right.
Let's give a good example. James Risen, the New York Times, talked to someone in, whether it's the National Security Agency, State Department, or something, to find out about the warrantless wiretapping. And that doesn't make James Risen or the New York Times criminal.
Right.
Just as the fact that there may have been contact between WikiLeaks in some way and Bradley Manning, and none of that has been proven, it's just by the government, even if there were, that doesn't mean that WikiLeaks was doing anything other than acting as the New York Times. The reason we haven't seen WikiLeaks prosecuted or Julian Assange is I think the government doesn't have sufficient evidence to say very much, both with contact or anything else, and because in the United States, the idea of prosecuting journalists for publicizing the kind of material that WikiLeaks publicized would be outrageous.
And also, Michael, the whole nature of internet law is in its infancy. It's hasn't been well established at all, given how quickly technology is changing.
Well, that's what's fascinating about this hearing, because you learn a lot about what the government can do, about what you have to do with your computers, about the ability to take a computer and figure out what's going on with it. And it's a real warning to people not to
be careful what you send.
You can be careful what you write, be careful what you send, but be more careful mostly about what you leave on that computer, because it's like a crime scene, quote, alleged crime scene after scene afterwards with like pieces of hair or like blood samples
or DNA.
Something. And you do have a way of course, unlike a crime scene, you can't, you know, throw out the whole room where alleged crime took place, but you can't throw out your computer, and you certainly can zero it out. And I'm not advising people to cover up the evidence of their crimes.
Of course not.
What I'm advising people is if there's embarrassing material on your computer, there's ways to get rid of it. Over the last few shows, we've been trying to update our listeners on the National Defense Authorization Act. It's been in the news a lot, an awful lot. That's the act that has provisions regarding indefinite detention and imprisonment and special trials for people picked up, captured, kidnapped, etc., in the so-called War on Terror. There's been lots of conflicting opinions about what these sections of the National Defense Authorization Act mean, whether they're decreasing Obama's power, whether increasing Obama's power, whether there's a threat to American citizens, etc. It's hard to bring a lot of clarity to this, but I'm going to try. First of all, as I speak, the National Defense Authorization Act has been passed by both houses and gone through conference, and is now on Obama's desk. The likelihood of him signing it are close to 100%. This is despite the fact that he threatened to veto the act because he felt that various provisions of the National Defense Authorization Act concerning detentions, in other words, Guantanamo-type stuff, might impinge on his authority as the executive. I'm not sure that he was at all concerned by the substance of the act. It was much more Congress telling him how he had to treat, he as the president had to treat, various people captured or kidnapped in the so-called War on Terror. In any case, after fiddling around with the act a little bit in light of Obama's threatened veto, the president then issued a statement saying, well, now that they've changed a few things, I'm not going to veto the act any longer. So now you have this spectacle of the president who said he'd veto it, getting a few little sops thrown to him, particularly around his own authority, and now saying at a public press conference that the president no longer plans to veto the act. So much for us feeling that Obama, in some way, was upset by the substance of the act. Here we have the spectacle of Congress being trashed because it's actually putting in a pretty nasty detention provision of both people picked up outside the United States as well as potentially inside the United States and all the stuff with American citizens. And you have Obama saying, well, I don't like this, I'll veto it. In fact, it's a flim-flam.
because the essence of the National Defense Authorization Act provisions on detention are essentially the same as what Obama is already doing with detentions in the world. So, for example, and I'll get into a little more detail, but so, for example, Obama already says he has the authority to pick up people anywhere in the world, whether it's in Afghanistan in a war zone, in Pakistan a semi-war zone, maybe under somebody's argument, in Yemen, not a war zone at all, in North Africa, not a war zone, in England, not a war zone. Obama's claimed authority to pick up people, capture them anywhere he claims the war on terror is going on, is something he does already. What the National Defense Authorization Act is put that into law, not just simply a president saying, I can do this. In that sense, of course, the National Defense Authorization Act is worse because it actually gives a congressional imprimatur to what Obama and Bush did before or are already doing. So it makes it a little harder to actually shift and change or challenge what Obama's doing, because now you have both the executive and the Congress saying this is okay to pick up and detain and capture people anywhere in the world and hold them indefinitely in prison, either because they're members of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or associated forces or even beyond that. But let's not kid ourselves. It's not worse than what Obama's doing. It just makes it more difficult. So on point number one of the National Defense Authorization Act, I think it's a flim-flam. But let's not get Obama off the hook and say it's Congress's fault. Let's just understand that this country, by accepting initially what Bush called the so-called war on terror, and the judges accepting it, and the Congress accepting it, and President Bush accepting it, essentially allows this detention authority and killing authority to go on everywhere in the world. Congress just put its thumb on the scale and said, we're going to agree also to it. But in fact, we have essentially a detention authority that is, in my view, completely illegal, outside of war zones, and completely lawless. A second aspect that's been much debated about the National Defense Authorization Act is the question of detention of American citizens. Now, in some way, I hate this part of the debate. It's been out there and everybody's really upset about it and crazy about it. But the question I would ask all of you is, why should American citizens not be subjected to the same thing that we subject everybody else in the world to? We pick up people in Egypt, we pick them up in North Africa, we pick them up in Yemen, we pick them up in Pakistan. Why should American citizens be given any more rights under law than the people in the rest of the world? Now, you may say to me, well, there's the American Constitution. But I would say to you, why does somebody in Yemen, why does somebody in Pakistan have any less rights to be killed by a drone or picked up and detained forever at a prison, whether in Guantanamo and Bagram? All of them are human beings. All of them are protected by international law that says it's illegal. And so what I was upset by in the last debates on the NDAA was all this stress about American citizens, because it took away the finger from pointing at the real fundamental problems with what the United States is doing, which is capturing and detaining people everywhere in the world. And the problem is, once you capture and detain people anywhere in the world, it's pretty easy to go to the next step if a U.S. citizen is involved in the, quote, same kind of alleged conduct. It's not a big step for picking up the U.S. citizen versus picking up the non-U.S. citizen. So I start from a premise that once you've accepted the war on terror, you've essentially accepted picking up U.S. citizens and detaining them forever. So now we go to the next question. What does the NDA actually say about this question of U.S. citizens? And many people who want to say, well, Congress isn't really authorizing the detaining of U.S. citizens. That's not clear in the act. We still have that fight. We can still do it. Obama doesn't agree with it, supposedly, et cetera. Well, let's clear up a couple of things. One is, there's two aspects of detaining American citizens or killing them with the drone. One is, are they American citizens and are they protected because of that status? And the second is, where are they geographically located? So let's say with American citizens, we know Obama doesn't care about American citizens as American citizens, because he launched the drone on al-Awlaki in Yemen and murdered an American citizen. We went into court to try and stop it. And yes, we think it's a violation of international law. We also think that person should have been protected by the Constitution. But fundamentally, it's a violation of international law. Al-Awlaki's outside a war zone. He's not engaged in imminent conduct of pressing a button to launch some missile on the U.S., and he should have been protected as an American citizen, but really as a human being anywhere in the world. The second question is, what about American citizens arrested in the United States who are allegedly involved with the, quote, war on terror? Well, again, once you accept the first step, that you can arrest non-American citizens anywhere in the world, why should the fact that they're in the United States make any difference? And of course, yeah, we have our Constitution, and good lawyers obviously going to argue the person has additional protections under the U.S. Constitution. But again, should it really make any difference whether that person is arrested in the United States or outside the United States? Well, what does the NDA do about it? What does the National Defense Authorization Act do about it? Does it do what people say, or what some people say, authorize the detention of American citizens picked up in the United States? The first backdrop to that is there's an open legal question on this. People may recall the case of Jose Padilla, the man picked up getting off a plane in Chicago, put in a military brig, a U.S. citizen, and eventually his case was litigated. How can you do that? He's an American citizen on U.S. territory. How can you do that? Well, the case went to the Fourth Circuit, and interestingly, Jose Padilla lost that case. They upheld his detention as an American citizen picked up in the United States. As it went to the Supreme Court, the Bush administration didn't want a test, and therefore they put him into a regular criminal case. So the law at this point is that if you're an American citizen in the United States picked up in the so-called war on terror, you can be held in a military brig and in military detention. Obama has never said he wouldn't exercise that. He hasn't done what the Bush administration did, but he hasn't yet said he would never do that. So right now the law, as I said, is never been tested in the Supreme Court on this, but a Fourth Circuit court has upheld it, and Obama has never said he wouldn't use that authority.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Political prisoner and good friend Lynn Stewart continues to uplift those around her while serving a 10-year sentence at the medical center in Fort Worth, Texas. Lynn, as many listeners know, was prosecuted for allegedly violating a special administrative order that prohibited certain kinds of activities in her representation of the Egyptian Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman. She was tried and found guilty of materially aiding terrorism. Lynn received a 2.5-year sentence instead of the 30 years that the government wanted. The government appealed the sentence, and the Second Circuit in New York sent Lynn's case back to the original sentencing judge. That judge then increased Lynn's sentence from the 28 months to 120 months, a 10-year sentence. Lynn is now 72 years old. She's a breast cancer survivor with other pending health issues. She's called those the usual brush fires of aging, yet many are concerned. Joining us today is Lynn's husband, Ralph Poynter, who's been visiting her and will give us an update both on how she is feeling and her work and solidarity with other prisoners throughout the world.
Welcome to Law and Disorder.
And thanks for having me. And I spoke to Lynn just a few days ago about being on the program. And her wishes were for me to express to all of the people who supported her and her position and continue to do so through letters and other support. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And as she says, LS, love, struggle, and the struggle continues.
You know, we had Lynn in the seat you're sitting in. I don't know, when was it? Two years ago?
She has served two years
oh,
in November. And she is looking forward to her attorney, Howard Farringer, presenting to the court once again, testing the law. In February, that'll be February 29th at federal court, and we are planning a occupy the courtroom and occupy the park the night before, the 28th, through to the 29th, the day of her, not her appearance, the day that there will be a hearing of her case. And she says you take each struggle as it comes. And she has the way of being funny. Her spirits are good while she's in jail. And she said to me, little did I ever think that I would be putting my hopes in the hands of Clarence Thomas. And I say, Lynn, that is funny, but not in your circumstance.
Ralph, tell us exactly what the lawyer will be asking for.
He will be talking about the sentencing, the change from the 28 months to the 120 months. Nothing changed. And the laws that Judge Codall used to extend his rationale for extending. It was as ridiculous, I guess, as you might say the weapons of mass destruction, but they got over with that, so they might get over with these two ridiculous cases that he used. One where they didn't know about a sex offender putting on video a 10-year-old that he was offending sexually, and another one where the government, when the sentence was given, did not know that the person being sentenced had stolen far more money, federal money, than they had imagined. So they used that as an example of being able to extend sentences.
So you're saying those examples don't work at all?
They don't work whatsoever.
And your choice of attorney is interesting. Harold Price Farringer is a very famous First Amendment and actually pornography attorney. Actually, in one way, not because of the pornography, but because those cases depend on one of them does a pornography, but really a First Amendment issue. And Harold would be the best person to argue those as saying you can't just resentence someone to a longer term because of the First Amendment protected speech.
Well, one of the wonderful things about Mr. Farringer, other than his record with the courts, and he has set the courts back on their heels several times, he, when I called him, he said any lawyer who didn't want this case didn't understand law. He looked so forward to doing it, and he went for a one-hour visit with Lynn at MCC and stayed all day.
That's
so
great.
It was a natural.
Wow. What court are you in?
Federal court right here.
But in the district court, the lowest
district court?
Right. It's starting again.
It goes right back to Codall, and it has to go through Codall, then back through the Second Circuit, and then if we don't get, no matter what happens, Lynn will continue to fight for her license.
Naive question. Since Codall is at issue, in fact, in his change in decision, I don't understand why it goes back to the same judge.
I would not say I understood it, but that's the way the law works. You've got to go back to the same judge. You have to go back to the Second Circuit again before you go on to the higher court, the Supreme Court.
So we understand the case. It's going to be argued. It has to do, of course, with the change of her sentence to a 10-year sentence.
Right.
From a 29-month sentence?
28 months. To 120 months. 10 years.
From two and a half years.
Yes. So it's a huge issue. Obviously, we're all very hopeful about that argument. Under the old sentence, we'd be looking forward to Lynn getting out of prison right now.
Yes, we'd be looking forward to Lynn getting out. And personally, Lynn is Irish, English, you know, and she has a German and Swede, and she has all of these things, and she says, you cannot speak positively because the gods will look down upon you and punish you. And I say, well, I'm black and my gods don't know my name, so I'm looking forward to Lynn getting out, but I hesitate to speak positively.
Little superstition
for fear
there.
Of right. the gods leaning on us.
You're not wrong about that. Let me go back to where Lynn is right now. She's been in over 2 years now.
Two years, November.
And what prison is she in?
She's in Carswell Federal Medical Center. That's in Fort Worth, Texas. Big air base there. It's an enormous prison. But she's in the hospital ward. And I remember the first time I visited her, that was on New Year's Day last year, and I was not on the list. I just says, you know, even though I was here in New York on the list, had been visiting her for 6 months, I just left. And with Lynn, she says she was getting a little lonely, and she says, you're not on the list, but I'm going to go to the floor supervisor, and she says, you just come without it. So when I left, I took the cheapest flight, and she called me the day before on a Thursday evening, and she says, where are you? I says, I'm sitting at the airport in St. Louis. And she says, great. So That Saturday morning, I was in front of the prison when they told me I was not eligible to go in. And it's like an airbase. So I walked outside the gate and stood there. And the guard came over and says, well, what are you doing here? I says, I'm waiting. And it was 8:30 in the morning. Well, it turned cold, and he says, you're not on the list. So about 10 o'clock, an official car, you could see the lights flashing, came down in from inside the prison and came out and said, you're denied admission. Oh, and I says, I understand, but I'm going to wait. Around about noontime, the car came back, and the woman got out, and she says, fill out an application. So I says, well, I've done this many times, so I filled it out. And another half hour, she left. Half hour later, she came back and said, I can't promise you, but you're going to get into the prison, large prison. Quarter mile away we go, and it's the hospital. And she says, everybody's on vacation. And she says, we'll see. So then around 12:30, they let me in and said, don't come back tomorrow. We're going to let you in this time. And I could see out the window through the gates and the bars, the body of Lynn standing there. She has that shape that you can't miss. And when we got there, when we met, she says, you know, like, I knew if you fought from the outside, I was going to fight from the inside. And it only took 4 hours. So I was in, and one of the first things she said, I said, how are you doing? And her standard answer is, Ralph, I'm in prison, you know. And then we went on to talk about her condition. And she says, you can't imagine, after sleeping on a 2-inch exercise mat on a steel platform for a year, 6-7 months, she says, when they showed me the hospital bed, and she says, I sat down on a hospital bed, a real bed. So she says, compared to what? And she's by a window that overlooks the air base and the prison. And she's done wonderful work in getting the inmates involved in bird watching. And she's made a request to people for books. And she has 8 or 10 books on birds. And it's she's an uplifting person. And she is Miss S in the prison.
Miss S?
Miss S. Miss S. Everybody brings her their papers. And she described the first day.
She's a real jailhouse lawyer.
Real jailhouse lawyer. When she describes the first day, she's in a cubicle with 4 other women. So she says 5 o'clock in the morning, she thought she heard sounds outside her prison. And when she got up to look, she says people had lined up. And she says some of them had stacks of legal papers.
No.
She says 3 feet high. And they're waiting for her to review the papers.
She's going to be busy.
Oh, she's very busy. But it's against the law in the prison to have and another inmate's legal papers. And she says, you know, there are no office hours in prison. So they sanctioned her for having the papers.
Wow.
But the interesting thing was she was depressed, that she couldn't move. She couldn't organize anyone. And when they sanctioned her for having the papers, the women in the prison did their own thing. Catcalling, name calling, you know, like going to religious services and speaking out against the so-called religious people, saying, you tell us to improve our lives, and here somebody comes and does something to improve our lives, and you sanction her. So the prison officials went to her and asked her to call it off, and she says, I didn't call anything on. And then they says, well, listen, let everybody know that we are regulated by the federal government. There are certain things we have to do, but we're going to go as easy as possible. And they did. And she has a standing in the prison and terrible situation. She says, there's oxymoron prison health care. There is no such thing. And she described a situation where a woman was on dialysis, was in her cubicle, and she got sick, and they tried to get a nurse, and the nurse said she's faking it. And then Lynn helped her down the hall towards the nurse's office, and they got across from the nurse's office. She couldn't help the lady. Can you imagine Lynn, who needs help walking right. herself, and this woman, and she got her into their bathroom, and the woman died on the bathroom floor.
Oh, Ralph.
And she said to me, Ralph, I don't want to go that way.
No.
Wow. And I'm saying, well, we're working as hard as we can on the outside to make sure that you do not go that way.
Ralph, give us an update on her health.
Her health is bad. It's the same as it was when she left, but she talks about how when she went to jail, she's lost about 40 pounds.
What?
And she says the first weight loss was due to the fact that she was on the fourth floor, a long way from the lunchroom, and she couldn't walk up and down four flights of stairs into the lunchroom three times a day. So she would pick the meal she wanted to eat. But she says in prison, you're photographed everywhere. And they called her into the social worker's office, and they showed her going up the stairs. She says she was embarrassed trying to go up the stairs holding on to the rails, and so they shift her to the hospital ward, which was closer. So then she says she was eating three meals a day. And then she said to herself, did she have to go to prison to lose weight? And so she had lost 10 pounds at the time. So then she said she was going to use her own discipline and lose weight. Mm-hmm. So she's lost 45.
Amazing.
And, but she's very sick. She can't sit down. In the visiting room, she has to sit sideways. She says the hospital bed is soft. Yes. She can sit down in a hospital bed, but to sit in the visiting room, we change seats, we move back and forth. She gets up, I pull her up on one side, then I pull her up on the other. They've changed regulations in the prison where they have doctors who come in and contract. Then they take you to the hospital where
privatized health.
Privatized health care. Z is talking with the doctor who came in. She says he sounds good.
Z?
Dr. Zenobia Brown, our daughter, the doctor. who was a genius in Columbia and Colgate. She's talking to the doctor to check his credentials, and we're hoping to get Lynn out to get the necessary surgery, which is a chance will improve. Can improve her condition.
So how many visitors has she been able to have?
Not many.
Yeah, let's go. Your visit was...
I'm visiting. Right. Zenobia's visiting. Our son, Jeffrey, a lawyer, has visited. Our daughter, the lawyer, has visited. Our granddaughter has visited with her great-grandson, to Lynn.
Right.
So it's very limited. Ralph and Maya tried to go. They let Maya in once.
Ralph and Maya are...
Shonman.
Right.
And
friends.
When she was in MCC.
Right.
Maya wants to see her again. And of course, when they showed me Ralph's arrest record, I had to laugh when I said to Ralph, what country have you not been in prison in?
Ralph Shonman, we're Ralph talking Shonman. About. He's from the Russell Tribunal.
Yes. They didn't let him in. We didn't expect it. But he wanted to visit Lynn and to talk with her. But Maya got in. Maya. Hopefully we'll get in again. And they allowed the local Episcopalian minister who had lived in Texas. She's approved. But
so people have to get approved in order
to
get in.
You have to get approved. And it's there's a list. She's been handing the list. But the gentleman, Mr. Polk, who was almost civil, retired.
Oh, from the facility.
And she says it depends on the next person who comes in. So we're trying to get people in to see her. Her longtime friend and her first law partner have gotten on the list to see her. And so, but it's a very small list. Due to credit to Lynn, when she found out that I was involved in bringing fresh food, farm produce, the projects in New York, she told me to not come visit her because there wasn't enough time. It was a weekly thing. And she says, when the project is over, then you'll have time and maybe a buck to come see her. So thanks again to all of the people who have been sending bucks for me to go see Lynn. I will continue, and thank you, thank you, thank you.
Give us a sense of how people can communicate or write to Lynn.
You can write to Lynn, you know, like look on the website.
What's the website?
The website is lynnstewart.org, L-Y-N-N-E, Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, .org, 53504-054. I feel like I'm in
That's
prison,
her number.
You know, like
yeah.
I know the zip code and all. Just look it up on the website, and it's, you know, you write a letter, and the letters pick her up. And one of the wonderful stories she tells is when she first got to Fort Worth, Texas, she was on the fourth floor, and people don't get mail. And she says the condition of women in prison is beyond belief or description. So they called the mail, and she was on the fourth floor. So when they got to 100, the whole place cheered. And they talked, you know, like they
100 began, is
100 letters that had been written to her at mail call when the mail call came. And she wants to apologize to everybody because recently she's been ill. And then we are fighting over the medicine. We had another fight. They gave her medicine. She couldn't get out of bed. And now we have a system where when they give her medicine, she calls me because she tries to call me once a day, use her 7 minutes. I call our daughter, the doctor in Florida, tell her what the medicine is. She calls me back. When Lynn calls me the next day, she's told whether to take it or not to take it. And so she has stabilized because they had given her the wrong medicine, just like in New York. She says it's a tragic situation. And she thinks of the people in prison who do not have advocates on the outside, who cannot call. And she says she's witnessed people dying. And there's a policy in the prison where you cannot give anyone your commissary. And she understands that.
That means you can't give them the credit that you have.
No, you can't buy something for them.
You can't, like, get a candy bar for them. You have to eat it yourself.
Well, what she said was people on dialysis need iron. There's no iron in the diet. The other day they had a thin slice of pizza and lettuce with no dressing. And she says this was a meal. And food is very important in terms of health. So she buys things for people on dialysis. She muscles have some of the products and they have iron in them, and she distributes food that way, even though it's against the rules. And she told them, put me in the bin now because I can't sit and watch people die. So they kind of look past, you know, the way she spends her commissary. So she's Lynn. She's just Lynn in jail with all the restrictions. It's a tragic thing, but her spirits, you know, when I see her, we always manage to laugh. We talk about the issues, you know, just like she's on the outside, and we find Friday, you can visit the weekend, Friday from 5 to 9, Saturday from 9 to 3, Sunday 9 to 3, Monday 5 to 9. We always find that we run short. There's so many issues to be discussed, and the political issues and a few of the personal issues.
But, Ralph, now you're on the list, so you don't have to go through that waiting outside for hours.
Waiting. You know, and they told me when I was there, they says, well, your acceptance sheet is in New York. Well, I said, gee, I just left New York yesterday. It wasn't there. And I says, well, that doesn't do me much good. To make a long story short, I never got the okay.
The acceptance sheet.
The acceptance
sheet. So, Ralph, it actually sounds, I mean, it sounds like because of outside help and Lynn's strength and, you know, her abilities that she's managing. But it actually sounds awful, to be honest. I mean,
it is awful when, you know, like I says, I see her form. She has lost 45 pounds, and she's very proud of herself. But she's bent. Yeah. And when she sits down, I have to hold her hand so she can sit down on an angle, and then she rolls back. And then she says, okay, I'm all right. And then after a while, I help her get up again, and then she leans on the other side. He says this is the nature of her illness, and that's why she wanted to get her operation before she went in.
Is there any chance she could be moved to a medical facility closer to New York?
That's an interesting thought. One of the things that happened the other day is one of the women who had been in jail with her in New York was transferred to Fort Worth. While she regaled everyone with the story of the demonstrations we had at the prison at MCC, and she was telling everyone, you never saw anything like that. They lost control of the prison. People were in the windows hollering. They couldn't get the women back in their cells. And somebody says, well, why are you here, Lynn? And they says because if Lynn was in New York, there would be demonstrations. If she was in Danbury, there would be demonstrations. They sent her here to get her away from
She's out of sight and out of mind of some, but not, some, but not for long.
Not for long. We're looking to keep her in the hearts and minds. And she always says to me, never speak of Lynn Stewart alone as a political prisoner. Speak of Leonard Mumia and all the other brothers or unnamed Angola. Talk about the lack of a left in dealing with our heroes, our political prisoners. And she says, never forget them. And she always says to me, well, they've done it to me, but it's a skid bit compared to the others.
Amazing statement. Amazing. Well, Ralph, thank you very, very much. And send our love to Lynn, our hugs. At some point soon, we'll have her back where you're sitting for an interview in the studio.
Well, I so look forward to that. And I'd like to see, you know, like people get to know the name of Harold Faringer.
Yes.
He is a wonderful man, and he has a wonderful record. And we're looking forward, as he is, looking forward to
February 28th. 29th. Okay, we'll put that on our website.
Yeah, a leap year. And she said to me, Ralph, Sadie Hawkins Day. And she says, and anybody who knows what that means, you know, is long past.
We'll put up materials on our website so our listeners can go.
Yeah, thank you again.
Certainly appreciate it, and I appreciate this.
Thanks, Ralph.
Thanks again.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
From 125th Street to a bridge called G-Dub, several shades of living. From diamonds to mud, a gateway to the city, just a few miles away, an expressway to the country. Politicians to those who have no lives, from garbage in the ghetto to the doorman in the heights, from super cool hustlers to the death screams in the night.